The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
Seeing Red Radio.
Truth is, there's been a class war waged in America for 30 years now, from the top down, and the rich have won.
We carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations.
To protect the haves from the have-nots.
Freedom is the universal gift of Almighty God.
To maintain the security of those who accumulate wealth from the labor of others.
We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense.
To protect wealth from the poverty that wealth creates.
We will work with our friends and allies across the world to defend our way of life.
Corporate and political powers connive to keep wages down while shredding the worker's safety net.
A time comes when silence is betrayal.
Seeing Red Radio.
We can usher in a new era of enhanced prosperity and peace.
The great American wealth machine has been cranking out jackpots for the people at the top.
America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace.
Pushing working people further down the ladder.
Did our generation advance the cause of freedom?
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
That time has come for us.
There comes a time when the operation of the machine is so odious.
I have been proud to be a part of a strong bipartisan consensus.
That you cannot even tacitly participate. You've got to place your bodies on the gears, the wheels, all the mechanism, and you've got to indicate to those who own it and those who run it that unless you are free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Gotta take the power back.
Solidarity, brothers, sisters, comrades in the struggle. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio, the radio show with a revolutionary socialist perspective. We believe another world is possible, and it is our project to make that world a reality. I'm your host, Anthony Udell. Welcome to this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio. Well, we will continue what we started last week with the world's attention focused on the Danish city of Copenhagen with our illustrious Nobel-winning president about to arrive to put together something that somebody might actually call a climate deal. We asked the very necessary question as we face the impending collapse of our ecology. Can capitalism save us from what capitalism has created, namely global warming? Tonight we'll listen to a talk from Socialist Workers Party member Alison Smith on Marxism and ecology. We'll also feature music by Mr. Liff, Jimi Hendrix, James Brown, Rahsaan Roland Kirk, and Bjork, just to name a few. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember, we do have a website at seeingredradio.org where you can tune in, check out previous broadcasts, and subscribe to the podcasts for future Seeing Red Radio episodes. Thanks again for tuning in. Okay, so right now, let's hear a little Mr. Liff with Earth Crusher, and then Alison Smith of the SWP right here on Seeing Red Radio.
At last, the day of the blast, disaster. Welcome to the hereafter. Government powers in conflict, in a world gone sick, and they're heavily equipped with arms to melt down cities and farms. The final stage witnessed the force of pure rage, while we were all
tracks in this atmosphere to which nobody adapts. No more sacks, rap shows of rage, sunshine of bulls, holidays, just radiation and tidal waves, death to the modern day slaves, running down the streets with our arms raised, atheists now give praise, the sounds of nuclear bombs whistle right past my ear, headed towards Zaire, many have died, but you better believe that more are bound to suffer, Earth Crusher!
Basically, Marx and Marxists have often been criticised for not having a very strong analysis of nature or for not talking about the ecological problems we face enough in our criticism of capitalism. And Marx in particular, and sometimes has been criticised for being anti-ecological in some way. But actually, if you look throughout Marx's writings, this is not actually the case at all. And he actually had a very strong sense of the importance of ecology, both in understanding the history of the relationship and the changing relationship between nature and society, but also looking at the unique way in which capitalism interacts with ecology and has changed the relationship between society and ecology. And actually, I think Marx's observations of this relationship between nature and society are extremely, extremely important in looking at the ecological crisis we face today. And what I think it offers is it offers a historical materialist perspective and a historical understanding of the way in which capitalism uniquely has changed the relationship between society and nature, and also actually the historically specific nature of the scale of the rate, the scale and the rate of change that we are now seeing in the environment. Obviously, there's always been natural change in the environment. Nature has been going through massive changes. Climate change, natural climate change, is something that we've seen, obviously, over geological time. But actually, the way in which this change is happening now is there's always been sort of characterized by long periods of stasis and then fast changes. But those are, you know, geologically relatively fast changes. But now we're seeing an unbelievably fast change in the way in which our ecological systems, natural systems, are actually reacting. And actually, if you look at it, this has happened within the time that capitalism, the very short amount of time that capitalism has actually been in place, showing the way, really, that the relentless way in which capitalism accumulates and extracts resources from the environment and then pumps back pollution into the environment leads to the systematic simplification of ecosystems and altering of natural systems. And I think that this analysis, this historical analysis and understanding of the way that capitalism has changed this relationship, is absolutely vital in the environmental debate today. And I think it's something that's really lacking, because if you look particularly, obviously, from the political side, the policy making around climate change, but also within the environmental movement, things tend to be very much framed in terms of capitalism, and the solutions are very much framed within the market, and very much sort of business as usual approach, when actually, because of the way in which capitalism has caused these problems, I think we actually need to be looking at solutions and approaches that challenge that system. But before I really go on to looking at that, I want to first talk about the current ecological crisis that we face and actually the scale of this, because we are facing a global ecological crisis, which obviously climate change is the biggest thing, the biggest threat at the moment. And actually, climate change threatens the survival of, you know, many, many species and also much of humanity. It threatens the way which we produce our food, climate systems, obviously, microclimates around the world, rainfall patterns, things like that. So we're going to be seeing, and we already are seeing, increases in flooding, hurricanes, and actually crop failures, and really, really massive changes, which obviously affect the poorest people in society the most. And in addition to that, we're seeing, on a scale like never before, mass species extinctions across ecosystems, the simplification of every ecosystem on the planet, which in turn makes those systems much less resilient to the change that climate change is bringing about. And really, I mean, this stems as a central feature, really, of capitalism, because the way in which capitalism drives to accumulate profit demands the ever-increasing use of resources, the extraction of resources from the environment to fuel new means of expanding production, and also when, obviously, fossil fuels using their energy, but also the increasing waste products back into the environment, the increasing new synthesized chemicals that capitalism churns out. I don't know if people have read a book by Rachel Carson called Silent Spring, but she talks about the way in which capitalism has created just numerous amounts of new chemicals which have gone into the environment in such quick succession that organisms haven't been able to adapt to that, and it's actually had a massive effect in simplifying ecosystems and causing mass extinctions. And really, this is based on an assumption at the core of capitalist ideology surrounding nature, which is that nature works and ecology works in a very mechanistic way, and that we can take the resources that we want from that environment, and then we can pump back the pollutants into that environment, it will assimilate those, and then we can take more resources and more and just continue to accumulate and increase production. But actually, this is a massive misconception of the way ecology and nature works, because a look at the historical way in which nature has changed shows that nature has within it a buffering capacity, but once that is exceeded, you start to see big changes happening. And this is something that is becoming very apparent now, and we're seeing that actually we can't continue to take more and more resources out of the environment and put pollutants back in without there being massive implications.
Distinct faces reaching up but not quite touching the promised land. Well, I taste tears and a whole lot of precious years wasted, saying, Lord, please give us a helping hand. Oh, there's got to be some changes.
So really, Marx talked about there being these massive contradictions in the same way that he talked about there being contradictions in capitalism's relationship to labour, in that it obviously both exploits mass majority of people, but also brings those people together in the workplace where they can organise against capitalism. It also, there are massive contradictions in capitalism's relationship to nature, because it takes all these resources out of the environment, which actually, you know, we have a finite world. You cannot continue to take natural resources from the environment without their scarcities arising. But also then it puts pollutants back into that resource base on which it depends for its resources of production. So actually, capitalism destroys the very systems which it depends on to provide it resources for production. And Marx talked about how capitalism is inherently flawed because it undermines the original sources of all wealth, one of those being the worker, who obviously produces the wealth from their own labour, and also the soil and the earth, because that produces the resources, and capitalism's endless both taking those resources out and then polluting them back with sort of the waste products of this production means that it's much less able to supply production to continue that increasing drive for profit and accumulation. And really, to explore this more, Marx talked about something called the metabolic rift, which basically the problem is not simply the scale of the economy under capitalism, but actually the very relationship between nature and society, because I mean, the example he used was much influenced by someone called Justus von Liebig, who was an agricultural chemist who looked at the ecological contradictions of industrialised capitalist agriculture, and actually how capitalist agriculture, characterised by mass production, monoculture, and the transportation of food miles from its source of production, which we see even more now with global agribusiness, leads to the removal of those soil nutrients from where they're growing the produce, to places, to cities, places far away from that area of production, which actually means the soil becomes very depleted from what it needs to grow those crops. And also, obviously, a system of monoculture means that the soil has much less diverse nutrients in it and is much less able to sustain production. And really, capitalism's response to this new system of agriculture and the reduction of nutrients was to develop artificial fertilisers, and obviously in response to the fact that you've got mass monoculture, which has very low genetic diversity, disease can spread very easily, developed massive amounts of pesticides. And we can see the consequences of using those things to sustain production. Actually, when those are washed into watercourses, into natural ecosystems, they massively destroy the ecology. And we can see, for example, the Black Sea, where this happened, the pesticides and fertilizers washed into the water. No one really noticed anything for a number of years, until the point where that accumulated within the sea and caused the whole of the fishery to actually die and collapse, and actually meant that masses of people had shortage of food and people's livelihoods collapsed as well. So really what we see as a consequence of the spread of global capitalism is that it has disrupted the basic processes of natural reproduction within ecosystems and with also in agriculture. As I said, this doesn't only apply to food production but also to ecosystems globally, as they become more fragmented, more simplified, they're much less able to buffer change. And we're really seeing this now, all these things coming to a head with climate change, because the fact that we've deforested so much of the Amazon rainforest means that actually the forest is less able to absorb carbon dioxide. We've got the potential for massive feedback mechanisms, with the Amazon being burnt and deforested more and more. That could release even more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which feeds back to speed up global warming even more. And really, the notion of this contradiction within capitalism regarding the fact that there are these ecological limits to growth is something that it's not just being noticed by people actively on the left, but it's actually something that's noticed by an awful lot of scientists, has been noticed by many economists over the years, and by ecologists. And it's becoming more and more apparent. It's been talked about a lot, even in political circles. For example, in 1972, a report entitled Limits to Growth came out, which actually stated that an economy based on the continued growth and accumulation is incompatible and unachievable in a finite world. And this was talked about, you know, in the world summits at the time. And since then, you know, we've seen a growing scientific understanding of these contradictions and the fact that we can't continue to pollute the world as we are polluting it. We can't continue to take all the resources we want from it. And climate change, really, I think, is probably one of the biggest ones, because, I mean, we saw that in 1988 was actually the first time that climate change came to the forefront of political debate. And in 1990, countries agreed to sign a treaty. They're going to actually start to do something about this. But it actually took, obviously, 13 years until a legally binding treaty came into place. So you've kind of got this, again, you've got this contradiction that, well, we know that these problems are happening, but yet nothing's actually being done about it in the mainstream political arena. And we had the definition of sustainability and the concept of sustainable development come about. And actually, the very definition of sustainability is to basically supply our current generation with the goods and resources and the welfare that we need now without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And actually, the definition of sustainability means that we need to break with our system of accumulation and the rapacious way in which capitalism takes resources from the environment and accumulates. And there's really no way of achieving that concept of sustainability without doing that. But yet what we've seen is the transformation of the definition of sustainability, and it's become used by Bush and Blair all the time in their speeches. But their concept of sustainability is actually based around economic growth, and this is what that has become. So really what we've seen, despite this increasing awareness about the ecological contradictions of capitalism, is that capitalism has actually become more and more geared towards accumulation and more geared towards extracting resources and degrading the environment. And while you might hear certain claims that actually, you know, now in the 21st century, our environmental awareness is much better, for example, animal welfare is better or water quality is better, these things might be true, but they're only really true in the richer nations. And what you see is that the worst, most polluting industries have just been exported to the poorer countries. And even on the whole, even in the rich countries, the actual emissions of global of greenhouse gases have actually increased massively as capitalism has developed. So why is this still happening then when we know all this? Well, it's partly to do with the logic of capitalism and the way capitalism works and the way capitalism reproduces itself, which I will come on to. But it's also the prevailing ideologies that surround ecology and nature within mainstream economics, but also within the environmental movement are actually, I think, quite flawed. Because neither of these understandings of the way nature works and the way that society interacts with nature are actually based on an historical understanding of the way that the relationship between society and nature has been in the past and the way that it has changed recently under capitalism, which has meant that they haven't understood really that how ecological destruction is such an intrinsic feature of capitalist development. So the current ecological crisis has tended to be framed either as a product of inappropriate market patterns, and therefore we need, in order to solve the crisis, we need to just sort of tweak at the market, change sort of the way that, so green goods will become, you know, more economically viable, so that the economy will be orientated around a kind of green capitalism, basically. Or the ecological crisis in terms of often in the environmental movement has been framed as a product of human greed, something that is inherent within human nature and within consumer society. We've become, consumer society is a natural product of people wanting to consume more, and that the main problem is overpopulation and people just generally consuming too much, and we need therefore a value change within our society in order to restore the what Marx called the metabolic rift. So really, to look at the capitalist view in a bit more detail, the view that just the ecological crisis is a product of inappropriate market patterns and can be solved within the market is, again, a very ahistorical view of the way in which the ecological crisis has come about, and also the view that nature is very mechanistic and can some way be any problems within nature can be solved using technology. But the concept that nature is immune to any level of interference has obviously had to, people have had to concede on that point, as we've seen massive ecological problems as a result of economic growth. And really, the main concept now that, that these people hold, and it ranges from people who are very right-wing, people like George Bush, for example, and then also people that would consider themselves within that view to be more left-wing, the green capitalists, if you like, actually will follow the same set of assumptions, which is that there aren't ecological limits to growth, essentially, because any limits or scarcities that come about can just be solved by the market, and sustainability can be achieved if the exchange value of a resource is correctly measured. For example, if something becomes scarce or something becomes a pollution problem, this will raise its cost, and therefore alternatives will be developed and technological innovation will be encouraged. But what we actually see is that we have a very homogenised form of production around the world, and the innovation is stifled through capitalism. So while we, at the moment, we know that fossil fuels are amazingly damaging, we're not actually seeing a massive innovation into renewable energies or the massive establishment of renewable energies around the world. Because of the way that global capitalism is organised and because of the competitive market system, it's very difficult, for example, for a country to change to renewable forms of energy, because it wouldn't be able to compete in the market. And even if it, even if a small country with the money to do so was able to change to renewable energy, actually it wouldn't make much difference, because you need the whole of the global capitalist world to change to that system, which they're not doing, because it would take a few capitalists to stand up and do it, and then they actually wouldn't be very successful as capitalists, because they'd lose their money. And it's just not the way that that works. There's a model called, I don't know if people have heard about it, called the environmental Kuznets curve, which basically explains this economist view, which basically is an inverted U-shaped curve. And they see that during the early stages of economic growth, pollution intensity will increase, ecological degradation will increase, until economic growth reaches a critical point. And at that point, the pollution problem will start to improve, and ecological destruction will ease off, until really there's no real impact of the economy on the environment. And the ideas behind this are basically that as affluence increases, people's demand for a better environment will increase, and also technology will improve, businesses will want to invest in more efficient technology. And the argument follows that this this model has actually been seen in advanced capitalist economies, and the environment there has become much cleaner. But this is a very, very flawed argument. If we look at the world now, we can see that the advancement of capitalism has only led to a worsening of the environment. And as I talked about earlier, although a few small environmental indicators we may see improving in advanced capitalist countries, actually their ecological footprint and their carbon footprint has increased massively. And you know, a lot of those industries have just been exported to poorer countries. And although on some level there's the argument that as people become more affluent, there's this sort of middle-class awareness about environmentalism and environmental issues that puts pressure on governments to act. But actually, although there might be a slightly greater awareness because people don't have such immediate pressures on themselves, those people actually have a much greater negative impact on the environment, generally consume a lot more, fly around the world to places, and actually creating a bigger environmental problem. So really, the idea that there can be this greening of capitalism through increasing efficiency and demands for a better environment actually is very flawed and doesn't really understand the political realities and the way that neoliberalism works, because it would require, for example, the power from the most powerful corporations in history, the fossil fuel corporations, the automobile industries, to actually be wrestled away from those corporations, which would obviously require the political will to do so. But when the interests of those businesses are so tied up within the governments of the world, this is obviously very, very very unlikely and not going to happen. And actually we see that the logic of capitalism works the other way, and instead of working towards a more sustainable situation, it actually moves towards a less sustainable situation. And we've seen this with the way that capitalism has progressed and the way it reproduces itself. And looking at neoliberalism now, capitalism has to find new means of repression to maintain its system of accumulation and its system of inequality, new ways of repressing workers to stop them fighting back, and also new means of exploiting the environment and the earth to extract more resources to use in its expanding production. And neoliberalism, as we know, is characterised by deregulation, which we have seen, you know, this is removal of all the restrictions to growth, or actually removal of a lot of environmental regulation. And if you look now at the UK's planning legislation, there's a meeting later on in Marxism about this, but actually it's very easy. The Secretary of State can overturn any decision they want to if they think that it's in the interest of economic growth. So an airport development, a power station development, and actually the other big one is military installations, can be pretty much built anywhere, despite the fact that they actually contradict with supposed government legislation on climate change. And obviously the other key feature of neoliberalism is privatisation, which has actually geared capitalism more and more to the exploitation of nature, has opened up the global commons to multinational corporations. And so really we see that the progression of capitalism leads to further and further ecological destruction and further class exploitation. And the capitalist idea that environmental sustainability and ecological sustainability can be facilitated through the market actually is capitalism relying on the institutions that have created ecological destruction to actually somehow solve the problem. And to briefly look at the other view, the other mainstream view held within the environmental movement about the way nature works and ecology works. There's a probably term deep ecology people have probably heard of. And actually this is something in a lot of ways to be sympathetic with, because it's something that has arisen in response to the consumer society that we live in, response to humanity's alienation from nature under capitalism. But there are also important areas where I think as a Marxist we differ from these views. And basically this comes in, I think, again, the ahistorical understanding of deep ecologists, of the way that nature and society has interacted, and the way that capitalism specifically has changed that relationship. Because within the deep ecology view, the main problem, really, as I said before, is consumerism. But obviously, we'd see consumerism as a problem, but actually as a Marxist, look at the cause of consumerism as capitalist production. And actually consumerism isn't something that has arisen as a result of people actually wanting to consume more and some sort of inherent human greed. But actually, if you look at the forces that are driving consumerism, it's driven as a means of furthering profit accumulation and also as a means of maintaining class-based exploitation and sort of keeping people quiet, if you like. It's a new opium of the people. And really, I think the key is that we need to understand the historical way in which capitalism has changed this relationship, and really the unique way in which capitalism has degraded the environment in such a systematic way. And I think both the economic views, the mainstream economic view, and the deep ecology view of nature tend to miss this. And really, I think the unique way in which capitalism degrades nature is something that we really need to bring into the environmental debate, because without this, I think you tend to find that the solutions to the ecological crisis remain framed in market solutions. And I want to look at a quote. A guy called István Mészáros talked about a lot of the relationship between capitalism and ecology, and he said that capitalism's ultimate destiny is where the destruction that is built into the logic of profit becomes to predominate, and ecological degradation not only undermines the conditions of production, but also of life itself. And I think that's what we're seeing now, because obviously throughout the years, as I've said, capitalism relationship to nature has meant that the conditions of production are undermined, in that if you're degrading your resource base, it's obviously going to be harder, and resources are going to become more scarce, and it's going to be harder for those systems to reproduce themselves. But also what we're seeing now as a result of climate change is that destructive uncontrollability is actually now threatening life itself and human life. And really, I think capitalism cannot be sustained. It's actually, you know, I think that's something that a lot of people accept, that this system of continually degrading the environment means that we cannot continue in the same way, because climate change is going to, if we don't do something about it, climate change is going to make economic growth impossible, because it is going to destroy so much human life and so much of the resources we depend upon. And really, I think this is where, I mean, for me, Rosa Luxemburg, when she talks about socialism or barbarism, I think that really rings true when you look at the environmental situation. And I think I just find it quite amazing when you look at the debate surrounding this, that this isn't something that's being mentioned enough. And I really do think that because of the ahistorical understandings of nature and the way that capitalism has changed nature, this has led to the dominant framework for assessing any ecological problems and their solutions to be framed within the market. And we really, really need to take this into the debate, take this into the movement more, and really be arguing that, you know, we do need an analysis that looks to the systemic causes of the problem within capitalism and looks to challenge that. And really, I mean, I'd like to finish on just a quote by Marx, and he said, "The only answer to the ecology of destruction of capitalism is to revolutionise our productive relations in ways that allow for a metabolic restoration. This will require a break with capitalism's own system of socio-metabolic reproduction, i.e. the logic of profit, because capitalism creates a contradiction within its own reproduction that means that it cannot be sustained, and the only means of creating a sustainable society is to restore this rift through revolutionising the means of production, i.e. to gear production around distribution according to need, as opposed to distribution, for the market." And I really think that that is the key, and we need to start going into the environmental debates, the campaign against climate change particularly, and saying that we need to look at solutions that challenge the real causes of the ecological problem, which is capitalism and neoliberalism. Thank you.
Alison Smith of the SWP right here on Seeing Red Radio. Please stay tuned. We'll talk a bit more about capitalism and ecological collapse.
powers. Block of power shield is necessary.
At COP15, the United Nations Conference on Global Warming, being held in Copenhagen, have been marked by walkouts and bitter rivalries on the inside and police repression of activists on the outside. The sense is dawning, even on those who hoped for progress on an agreement to slow greenhouse gas emissions, that whatever deal is put together by the end of the summit will be much too little and much too late. Even as Danish police crack down on the estimated 100,000 protesters, arresting hundreds of people each day, firing tear gas and beating some who tried to push their way into the Bella Center where the main talks were being held, meetings inside the center ground to an abrupt halt earlier this week when a group of poor and developing nations, including many of those already feeling the most severe effects from climate change, walked out in protest. Led by delegates from African nations and backed by the Alliance of Small Island States and the Group of 77, which includes many developing nations, as well as larger ones such as Brazil, India, and China, members walked out of negotiations on the morning of December 14th. The delegates returned to the conference later that day, but the underlying issues remain unsolved. The walkout was sparked by opposition on the part of large industrialized countries, primarily the United States, to accept binding emissions targets set out in the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, which, of course, the United States has never signed. A leaked draft proposal for a new climate change agreement at this summit presented by Denmark and clearly influenced by the United States and Britain would, in direct opposition to the Kyoto Protocol, weaken the UN's role in providing financing for climate measures and force developing countries to commit to specific emission cuts and other measures that were not part of Kyoto. Lumumba Diaping, chair of the G77, the name for the Group of 77, was quoted as saying, quote, "It denies the fact that developed countries have a historical responsibility for damaging atmospheric space, and it demands that a negotiated treaty kills off the Kyoto Protocol," end quote. The so-called Danish text was supposedly a long-term vision, organizers explained, but developing nations demanded that rather than prioritize this vision at Copenhagen, wealthy developed nations, frequently the biggest polluters, must first recommit to the binding targets called for by Kyoto. Jeremy Hobbs of Oxfam International explained to the Sky News, quote, "Poor countries want to see an outcome which guarantees sharp emissions reductions, yet rich countries are trying to delay discussions on the only mechanism we have to deliver this, the Kyoto Protocol," end quote. Unsurprisingly, delegates from countries that are the most resistant to firm limits on greenhouse emissions scolded the delegates who walked out. There is an element of truth to the charge that the walkout was a tactical maneuver, given its support by China and India, countries that are loath to place restrictions on emissions for fear it will curtail their economies. As the Interpress service noted, China and other major polluters from the developing world have proposed only conservative targets for reducing emissions, failure that is linked to the reluctance of developed countries to pledge significant funding to the roughly $200 billion a year that will be needed for adaptation, mitigation, technology transfers, and capacity building. But industrialized countries, particularly the United States, have much more to answer for. As UN Framework Convention on Climate Change Chief Ivo de Boer noted, the emphasis on what countries in the global south should do to keep their emissions low seems outrageous in many ways. In India, DeBoer said, there are 400 million people without electricity. How do you switch off the light bulb that you don't have? By any realistic measure, the limits on emissions sent under the Kyoto Accords 12 years ago are woefully inadequate. That there remains such obstinate refusal to abide by its provisions among the richest and most polluting nations shows just how little those at the top are willing to do to curb emissions. In other words, profits are being put above the planet yet again. In all, developing nations are asking for a commitment of some $200 billion from industrialized countries to help them tackle the effects of global warming. Even that paltry amount, far less than the U.S. alone has spent on its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is double the amount of money currently on the table. As Di Aping said, quote, the American Congress has to be asked, you approve billions of dollars in defense budgets. Can't you approve $200 billion to save the world? Although G77 countries came back to the table the same day of their walkout, talks appeared to stall again later in the week, as tensions between the United States and China came to the fore over how to ensure compliance with whatever deal is finally negotiated. China, which only recently agreed to a target for reducing the rate of its greenhouse gas emissions, has refused to accept any international monitoring. The Obama administration negotiators, taking a page out of the playbook of its predecessor George W. Bush, are insisting that they can't agree to any deal unless China agrees to monitoring first. Underlying this dispute is the idea that curbing emissions will require steps that could be detrimental to both the United States and Chinese economies, which are increasing competition with one another. The U.S. is also calling China's stated emissions reduction goal too low. Representative Edward Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, a co-sponsor of the climate and energy bill that passed the House in June, told the New York Times, quote, if China or any other country wants to be a full partner in global climate efforts, that country must commit to transparency and review of their emissions-cutting regime. Without that commitment, other governments and industries, including those in America, will be hesitant to engage with those countries. End quote. That kind of rhetoric is incredibly hypocritical, considering that the United States itself has still not officially signed onto the Kyoto Protocol, leaving it virtually alone in the world. The impasse between China and the United States in Copenhagen threatens to spark a new trade war, which calls for tariffs on Chinese imports into the U.S., since the House climate bill allows for imposition of tariffs on countries that don't cut carbon emissions. As the New York Times noted, quote, a group of 10 Democratic senators wrote to Mr. Obama 2 weeks ago, warning that the Senate would not ratify any treaty that did not protect American industry from foreign competitors who do not have to meet global warming emissions limits, end quote. Such squabbling led the red-faced Danish Prime Minister Lars Rasmussen, as he was called by the website Politico.com, to lecture delegates that, quote, people around the world are actually expecting something to be done from us, end quote. Well, fat chance. In all likelihood, the talks will not have progressed far enough for a final deal by the time heads of state, including Barack Obama, arrive in Copenhagen today and tomorrow. More importantly, the battles are giving a glimpse into how countries, business, and economic interests are driving the talks. Rather than a real consideration of how severe the climate crisis actually is, the proposals that have a chance of being taken up are so woefully inadequate that according to a December 14th media briefing from the Climate Action Network, a deal signed on the basis of what was on the table at the beginning of this week would lead to increased emissions causing an estimated 3.9 degree rise in average global temperature far beyond the critical threshold of 2 degrees that would result in catastrophic climate change. Provisions to protect the rights of indigenous people, a key part of a proposed agreement to reduce emissions due to deforestation, have been stripped out of the legally enforceable main body of the proposed text and moved, instead, to the preamble. Moreover, the thrust of whatever agreement is reached will rely heavily on business-oriented, quote-unquote, solutions to emissions. To take one example, at the conference, U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu announced that Renewables, an efficiency deployment initiative, an international energy partnership created under the Obama administration that brings together the industrial nations responsible for more than 85% of global carbon emissions. Under the program, these countries would spend $350 million, that's million dollars, over 5 years, including $85 million from the United States to accelerate deployment of renewable energy and energy-efficient technologies in developing countries. The program can't even be called window dressing. First of all, $350 million is a paltry sum, in no way adequate to make a dent in cutting emissions in the developing world. To put the figure in perspective, the U.S. will spend about $85 million on just 85 soldiers this year alone in Obama's Afghanistan surge of 30,000 troops. Even more problematic is the fact that the program would push countries in the global south towards things like energy-efficient appliances, presumably made by companies like General Electric. Meanwhile, back at home, the main culprits of global carbon emissions in industrialized nations, including fossil fuel-based industrial production and automobile use, are left relatively untouched. In all, the United States and Canada had announced emission cuts of 4 and 3% from 1990 levels by 2020, respectively, far below what is needed. As was recently noted in an issue of SocialistWorker.org by Chris Williams, quote, "The industrialized countries have offered a combined cut of just 10 to 17% of their emissions from 1990 levels by 2020. That sounds good, except that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, stated 2 years ago that emissions needed reducing by at least 25 to 40% to even stand a 50-50 chance of avoiding the 2 degrees Celsius threshold. When it comes to money, the European Union has announced that at least $100 billion per year is needed to counter the effects of climate change. Most environmental organizations put the figure much higher. Yet so far, a quick start fund of just $10 billion annually until 2012 has been pledged, with the EU pledging $3.6 billion. The U.S. has so far remained silent on what it will chip in." Well, actually, as of this article, which is written probably earlier today, Hillary Clinton did pledge that she would get together with other countries and pose, I believe it was $100 billion by 2020. Again, relatively paltry and very nebulous. Meanwhile, the voices of the estimated 100,000 protesters who came to demand action were being repressed in the streets, hardly the picture of Copenhagen, as the city has been branded on banners and signs that authorities were hoping for. A People's Assembly on December 16th was declared illegal despite having previously granted a permit and was violently broken up. A march of hundreds of indigenous activists was prevented from joining the assembly, and journalists attempting to cover the repression were turned away. In his speech in Oslo, accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, Barack Obama called on countries negotiating in Copenhagen to reach for the world that ought to be. But as is becoming clear from what we know is likely to end up in the final agreement, we can't trust the politicians to deliver the world that ought to be to us. We'll have to fight for it. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. That was an analysis by Nicole Smith. You can find that in the latest edition of The Socialist Worker. You can find that online at socialistworker.org. Well, that just about wraps up this edition of Seeing Red Radio. We'll be back a week from today. It'll be Christmas Eve. Of course, check out the website at seeingredradio.org and subscribe to our podcast. Please check us out. I'll leave you with David Rovix. Thanks again for tuning in. Stay tuned. Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, Northampton.
Driving down this highway, path to shopping mall. I see billboard after billboard, hear the advertisers call. I see cars and I hear cars and I smell cars all just like mine. I see a world covered with asphalt, you're in parking lot G9. Just sprawling on forever, doesn't even have a name. It's a land where everything looks the same. The signs rise high above us, flashing day and night, Verizon Wireless, Holiday Inn, Coca-Cola Light. There once was grass here, maybe forest, but none of that's here now. It's just product after product, as much as time and space allow. My in Tennessee or Texas, Baltimore or Burlingame, I'm where everything looks the same. Forests, family farmers, or the commons, heart of town. Does it make money? That's the question. If it don't, we'll knock it down. There's not a bicycle for miles, not a soul in sight that can't be seen behind a wheel, a few feet from the headlights. I don't know my neighbors, and I feel ashamed. Here where everything looks the same. If you don't like the Walmart, take these drugs, you'll feel okay. Now go sit behind the register and pass your life away. Eat these burgers from the factory, and if you should get fat, just give us some more money, and we've got some drugs for that. In this nation of individuals, is there one that we can blame? Why everything looks the same? I'm driving past the clear cut with the brand new multi-cinema and the massive mural painting, the latest enema. I think of moving eastward, maybe Ghent or Amsterdam, far from Ronald McDonald and his greedy Uncle Sam, where life looks more like life and not some cardboard money game, where everything looks the same.
Of the times for real choices and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his convictions. But we must all protest. Now that is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle, but I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit, and if we ignore this sobering reality, and if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and layman concern committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end, unless there is a significant and profound change in American life and policy.